All right, it's Liam. I want to thank everyone at the Oasis Podcast, as you were.
Hello and welcome back to the Oasis Podcast, the ultimate audio guide to Oasis. The time is almost upon us, people. If you're coming to Finsbury Park, we're almost there. I'm recording this on Wednesday evening and it's almost upon us. Friday is the day when Liam Gallagher is going to be headlining Finsbury Park in his own sort of mini festival, effectively, which is really exciting and we're really looking forward to it, having followed the last few days of his shows in Ireland. He's on a great form. The set list is looking fantastic. Having bought back Bring It On Down and Whatever and Listen Up, along with the other tracks he's been playing, the ex-Oasis tracks and the As You Were tracks that he's been playing. So yeah, so exciting. As you may have seen on social media, we are having a meetup. So the plan is to meet at the 12 Pins pub, which is not too far away from Finsbury Park itself, at 12 o'clock. So that's the plan. I'm going to be there from then. We haven't got tables booked or anything significant like that. We're just going to be there, have a chat, have a laugh. So come and say hello. Come and buy me a beer. Although if all of you buy me a beer, that might be a bit worrying because I'm not sure how many people are coming, but it sounds like quite a lot. But yeah, and then we'll see how that goes. Head into the venue as and when. Depends on how busy that pub is, I suppose. And then we may well continue and just do a bit of a meet-up in the venue when we get in there. Doors are open from 1:30. Music starts from 3:30. I've got no other plans. I had contacted both Warner's and the Festival Republic, who are putting the show on, about getting a press pass and getting behind the scenes and doing a bit of interviews, you know, preferably Liam, but other than that, then other people from the other bands I'd be happy to chat to. But Tumbleweed all gone quiet, so nothing from them, I'm afraid. But what that does mean is that I'll be around all day to speak to you guys. So come on down, have a chat, tell us your Oasis story, tell us what you've enjoyed with the podcast, and we'll record, and you could feature in an upcoming episode of the podcast. Very exciting. And for everyone else in the rest of the world, or if you didn't manage to get tickets, I'm very sorry. Well, no, I'm not actually. I'm not sorry at all. But anyway, it's all good fun.
I love it. Room for everybody here. Yes, all are welcome. Yes, indeed. I love them. Fun. Nice. Life. Youth. Beautiful. I'm all for it.
I think most people would admit they've been a bit disappointed with the lineup. The likes of DMAs, I know that a lot of people really like and excited to see. Wolf Alice are a good band. Sherlock's, Twisted Wheel are, you know, one of those groups that, you know, had loads of potential, but then they had their own problems and never really reached the level that a lot of people felt they should have. And there's a lot of names that, I'll be honest, I don't know. You know, it seems like there's a lot of names from Debbie's stable of artists, from Fear PR stable of artists. So we'll see if they're any good. Yeah, looking forward to it. I say there's two stages, and the majority of the bands I wanted to see appear to be on the main stage. So yeah, so we will have a wander around and play it by ear on the day and see how it goes. We are still hoping that there is a bit of space. If you look at the lineup, there is a bit of a gap between Wolf Alice and Liam. So could that be a special guest? Could it be Richard Ashcroft? That's been the rumour for a long time. That's what we've been hoping. He's been playing with Liam on a number of other shows. Could it happen? You'd have to think so. You'd have to hope so. But as I say, we shall see. And will we get an appearance from Sabone? He's followed Liam around and done most of the big shows. So we've got to hope that Bonehead makes an appearance at Finsbury Park. It'd be very surprising if he doesn't. So yeah, that would be great. We can see two-fifths of Oasis, at least.
Fucking mega. blood, bitch, bang, what, fuck them, can you carry you out? La la la.
Second
day. Oh, shit. I met a funny fucking girl on the crowded beach in Spain. Her name's Evelyn. She said she came to Spain to have a good time. That's right. She was with her mum. She was with her mum. It would have faced like an unnamed fucking, an unnamed pain.
But it said her name was Doc.
She didn't have to talk a lot.
I couldn't tell if she was mad or not.
La 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 la.
Right, we're on it.
Don't you know?
Right.
Other than that, there's been no other major news this week. Both Noel and Liam have been playing gigs, but it's been pretty much the same set list that we were aware of. So the big change was, I covered off in the last episode, was Liam bringing back the three Oasis songs that I mentioned. So it's been really good to have those and have high quality versions of those. And a lot's been written about Liam's voice. I think it is, you know, it's coming to the end of the tour now. He is obviously struggling a little bit. So let's do a bit of a comparison. Now, a good option here is Rock and Roll Star. Let's have a bit of Liam doing Rock and Roll Star back in the early days, back on the first sort of tours, plus then a later period Oasis. And then when he's just come back on this new tour, plus then one of the more recent shows. And let's just do a compare and contrast.
Sometimes in the sunshine, I've got a slow life down. The pain's moving just too fast for me.
So yeah, as you can see, it feels to me like his voice, just the way that he's phrasing, is tending to go back to how he was later Oasis, which is more barking out the words and sort of missing out some more of the nuance in the way that the melody is structured. He's not really following the melody like he used to. But, you know, I think it's completely understandable when you think about what he's done to his voice over the years and just the way he sings, the way he performs, the way he wrenches out those vocals. You can't do it and expect the voice to hold up. So, hey, at least he's been finishing most shows. He hasn't had many cancellations. Well, not in the UK anyway. Sorry, America. I know you had a few. But yeah, ultimately, I think that was the concern. If you go back and listen to the podcast, I think that was my big concern back when they announced all these tour dates. I was thinking, well, is he really going to get through all these shows? But yeah, he has pretty much in the main, other than those American ones that we mentioned. Anyway, let's get on to the main interview for today. And it is a cracker. It is with Ian Robertson. Now, as you may know that name, Ian wrote one of the first books about Oasis, which was Oasis, What's the Story?, which detailed his time with the band as tour manager in sort of 94, 95. So it's a really interesting period. So make sure you get hold of the book. If you get it, you can get it sort of on Amazon or on Kobo or any of those sort of apps, or a physical real copy, obviously. And yeah, it's a really good read. Very interesting, a few lovely insights. And we dig into quite a lot of that stuff with Ian in the interview. And a couple of changes and a couple of little added bits that he hadn't mentioned in the book, which is always good to tease out and get a little bit of extra info that we didn't know about the Oasis story. So anyway, I won't bury the lead anymore. Just to say, I spoke to Ian on the evening. The first England game against Tunisia had just ended, and England had scraped a 2-1 win with a last-minute goal. So that's where we kind of start the conversation. So anyway, so over to me talking to Ian Robertson. Need a little time to wake up. Need a little time to wake up. Need a little time to wake up. Need a little time to rest your mind. You know you should talk as if you might as well. What's the story falling cold? Well, need a Hi Ian, how are you doing?
I'm good, mate, thank you.
Wonderful, good. Did you enjoy the match?
Well, I didn't see. I've just literally seen the back end of it now. We got called out to a fire at just before England scored their winner. So I've just caught up on it all now. It was a bit lackluster, I thought.
Yeah. It's one of those, isn't it? It's so tricky because it's... Yeah, you watch everyone else, and I think everyone else kind of gets a pass, and then England play, and it's like, oh, it's not good enough, but
yeah. And I suppose we've got a vested interest in it, in a way that we don't have watching any of the other teams play.
Yeah, I think so.
More emotionally sort of engaged, I guess.
I suppose you...
And, you know, at the end of the day, you look at it and go, I mean, I'm not a huge football fan, to be honest, but I like the World Cup, and they got the job done.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, I say we. I'm actually primarily an Ireland supporter. I come from Irish parentage, so I'll follow England, and I'm happy when they win, but I do like to laugh when they lose. Basically, is my.
Well, I'm Scottish, and like you, I'm happy when they win, but I'm not going to lose too much sleep when they don't.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Good, but if I kind of started off just giving a big plug for the night in Weston, which is very exciting.
Yeah, it's Tim Abbott and I were, who still see a little bit of each other from time to time, we're chatting about about the fact that there's so much misinformation out there, and actually, to paraphrase Donald Trump, fake news. You know?
Yeah.
We look at stuff that kind of hits the mainstream media, and you kind of just roll your eyes. It's like, well, that isn't what happened. That's not how it happened, and they weren't there. You know. But out of that came, why don't we do one of these kind of stand-up audience with things? And then we left it at that. And then a friend of mine was putting on this Oasis Blur show in Weston, and I thought this might be the ideal opportunity to get up and give it a go. So I suggested it to him, and he said, yeah, I'd love to do it. And then I called Tim, and then the next thing you know, it's on, you know. And coincidentally, Tim has this incredible catalogue of material, filmed photos, etc. In fact, a huge chunk of Supersonic came from Tim.
Oh, wow.
A huge chunk of Supersonic came from Tim.
Yeah.
And he's got better, you know.
But he's got better, sorry?
He's got better material.
Oh, he's got better material. I thought, absolutely. What's wrong with him? Is he going... No. No, he's got really good stuff. Yeah, well, it's cool. I mean, I noticed on the Supersonic credits that he gets obviously a massive thank you. So,
yeah.
I suppose, you know, it's funny, isn't it? These days, everyone's got a smartphone. Everyone's recording everything all the time, and yet, it's like I look back at, you know, I hardly had any photos from my time at university. It's just no one has a camera out. You know, it was a big deal to bring a camera out. Why you got a camera? You know. Whereas,
and the cameras back in those days were the size of a small fridge in any of it, weren't they? Anything that was any good.
Yeah. But Tim kind of clocked and thought, actually, you know what, this something's happening here, and this would be worth documenting.
There was definitely an element of that. For a period of time, I was shooting stuff on a Creation Records camera that all fed back in through to Tim, and Tim picked stuff up every time he came out on the road. I think Tim always has a sense of zeitgeist, you know, he's always got a sense of the moment.
Okay.
And how that might resonate further down the track, or might just be of value to them as a record label or to the band as a band, management as management, etc., etc. They were, he was building marketing tools at the end of the day, just capturing what was going on, you know.
What is going on in this room now? Can walk next door to boys' home, yeah? Go in there and be like, hey, fuck. Oh, Jesus Christ, this fucking, we've got to get this fucking thing together now, because, like, it's not in time. And, like, if it's not in time, this fucking mean you're going, like, hey. You go in there, Dave, and he's like, well, hey, come on, hey. Like, we come in this room, and it's like, you know, it's the funny farm. And that's what it's all about. It's like, do what you frigging want. If you want to go, like, that, do it, because it don't mean nothing. If you want to go, do that. If you want to go, hey, fuck, man. Hey, fuck, like, do that. But if you want to just do this, what I'm doing here now, just do it, like, because it's like, right?
This is an advert for not taking drugs.
No, this is an advert.
It's an advert. It's not getting into chemical in these big time.
Hey, people who know that I have not been a fucking, I've never been an abuser. No one's, I've never been an abuser, I've been a user. I've never been an abuser, man. And they know, they do drugs, they do the air, man. And that is it.
And of course, the thing with Tim was, unlike really anybody else in those early years from the management structure, he was there.
Yeah.
You know, Marcus had his hands full. Marcus got out as often as he could, but Marcus had a whole lot to deal with. And so he was at kind of Ignition headquarters, or he was at the record label. When we were out, or he was at the big shows, you know, New York, London, Los Angeles. But when we were out on the road, properly on the road, we were just like this little gang.
Mm.
And Tim, out of that kind of management hierarchy, was really the only person that we saw with any regularity and who shared the tour bus with any regularity and who kind of stayed up late with us with any regularity.
Mm. No, it's really good. It comes across really well in the book that this... you know, it is like a little unit. You know, you've got yourself, obviously, the band members, and then, you know, Tim and Mark Coyle, and, you know, and it's you just get this real impression of, oh yeah, these are the people that matter. These were the people that were actually there, and a lot of people can kind of claim to have been hangers on, but you know, you guys were actually there in the maelstrom, and I think
and it's exactly that. Look, there were some people that did incredible things for the band, the Brian Cannons of the world, we didn't see a great deal of them, and we certainly didn't see them when we were in Salt Lake City, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we might see them in London, we might see them in Manchester, we might see them in Glasgow, but we did not see them in Frankfurt, we didn't see them in Sweden, we didn't see them in some, you know, crappy little club in France.
Sure.
On those instances, it was maybe half a dozen, seven or eight people max, you know?
And the Cat in the Hat on occasion.
Yeah, well, you know.
I've interviewed Simon on here, and he's. I don't know if you followed his. If you're aware of what's happened to him, but he basically.
I actually know Simon very well.
Oh, do you?
And he and I are in fairly regular comms. You know, that, to be fair, with the best will in the world, Simon wasn't really there either.
Okay. Yeah, I think I get the impression he was there for, as you say, like the London shows. You know, if he was around and available for the London shows, and his book's great, but you can tell it's like, okay, well, these were the points where he was there for, you know, and he was like to be called upon when required in those instances.
For services rendered.
Yes, yeah, and for the Manchester City, what does he call them? The Manchester City netball team, I think he called them. But, yeah, to avoid libel. But, I mean, that was just, I mean, going back to sort of your book, and one of the questions that we had was, I can't find it now. Oh, yeah, here we go. So this is Terry Appleby, who's at Stelly1274, said, what was the toughest, the Gallagher job or being in the SAS?
that's actually. And it really depends on how you kind of approach it. Physically,
yeah.
the military special forces is a nightmare. Emotionally, the whole Oasis thing was a real challenge. There was an intensity there in those early days that you genuinely cannot begin to imagine. And you know, at the point at which I started working with the band, I already had a pretty decent track record. You know, I had Johnny Rotten under my belt, I had George Harrison under my belt. You know, I worked with some pretty serious bands. But to be with a band in those very early days, when frankly every day was a surprise. What's really interesting for me is that if you look at the kind of rhetoric that Noel was using, you know, it's written in the stars, this is inevitable, that kind of arrogance that the mainstream media picked up on, I can tell you categorically, every single day was as much of a surprise to him and to Liam and to the rest of the band as it was to the rest of the world.
Hmm.
You know, when Rob Ballantyne and Simon Moran at SJM first booked the Sheffield Arena,
mm-hmm.
and we went to see it for the first time, Liam turned on him and said, "You know, you fucking idiot, we will never, ever sell this venue." Because it was so much of a leap from what we were used to playing.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd just come back from Europe where we were playing to 200 people max, you know, always to full houses. And Rob Ballantyne just turned around and said, "Well, actually, you've already sold it."
It's sold out already.
The tickets went in hours, you know, and that was like, really? So that kind of, that sort of, you know, yeah, I always knew. They really didn't.
Mm.
They really didn't. And it was as much of a surprise to them as it was happening as it was to anybody else.
Right. Going to play a brand new one. I only wrote it on Tuesday. So no one's heard this before. This is for Mavers, by the way. You've not heard this one yet, mate. I haven't got a title for that either.
Slip inside the eye of your mind. Don't you know you might find a better place to play? You said you'd once never been. All the things that you've seen are gonna fade away. So I start a revolution from my bed. You said the brains I had went to mine. Step outside, summertime comes. Stand out beside the fireplace and take that look up off your face. Cause you ain't ever gonna burn my heart out.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that sort of, I was rereading your book and you sort of think, because you had, as you said, you had worked with all these other people and yet you see them on this one occasion and you sort of go, yeah, I'm going to pin my colours to this mast. And yeah, and at the time, I know they had management and stuff and there was a buzz about them, but they weren't, you know, that this was a step back for you. I mean, and also... You know, what made you just think, no, this is the band that I want to align myself to?
Well, I worked with a band called the Sisters of Mercy. Out of that came a band called XCNN. Tim Braceno was kind of the driving force behind that. And I was in New York with him for a series of musical shows, seminar, new music, what was it, new music seminar, I think it was called.
Right.
And XCNN were playing on the same bill as Oasis. At a really tiny little club, and I think I allude to it in the book, a place called the Wetlands on the Lower West Side, if memory serves. And I knew Marcus because he and I were friends already. We'd been introduced by a mutual friend and kind of got along. So it was nice to see him. I picked up on the buzz that there was, and you're right, it wasn't incredible. It wasn't this is the future of rock and roll, but there was a buzz. And so I hung around to watch the Oasis set, and they were blistering.
Remember, mate, halfway through the gig, you're only four people away from me. You just good job I'm in a good mood, gar kid.
Yeah. Telling you, probably English and all, aren't he?
Because I'll fucking be in there, mate.
Whereabouts in Liverpool are you from?
Colombia.
But what's funny is in the book you mentioned that, you know, I think Liam, you mentioned him shoving Marcus Russell out of the way and then getting on stage. And so
that stayed with me, not knowing any, you've got to remember that at that point I know nothing about any of them as individuals or characters, and none of the stories have been written. And that is a statement that I make in the book with the benefit of hindsight and having been on the road with them for 18 months, 2 years. But at the point, Marcus was literally just there to shake his hand and wish him well. Liam was completely focused on the mission at hand. And he literally just kind of physically almost threw Marcus to one side. And there was nothing playful in that. Nothing playful in that at all. There was no playful irony. There was no, you know, it was kind of, get out of my way, I've got a job to do.
Yeah.
And it was pure venom. And I saw something there. What I saw there was, you know, what you want to see in a rock and roll star, was venom and darkness and a bit of danger and anger.
Yeah. No, that's spot on. And I love, I mean, similar, you sort of, you know, later on when you're already managing, I think it was your first run with them, I love the story that you're, when they're playing at the Hacienda, and talking about shoving, it's like every person in Manchester is trying to get on the stage. Oh, I want to watch it from the side of the stage. And, you know, and you're having to stand there and go, no, Sean Ryder, you're not watching it from the side of the stage. I love that.
He did actually threaten to kill me that night. He did actually say, you will not leave Manchester alive. I'm going to have you shot.
And did you, I mean, I suppose at the time as well, he's. I mean, he's quite a jolly kind of elder statesman of rock sort of chap now, but that was not the case in those mid-90s. I mean, that was a...
That was not the case, and he actually brought some sort of meatheads down as well. So it was actually a fairly fraught occasion, but, you know, but I'd been given a job to do, and I'd been given a very specific job to do, and actually it was Noel that said to me, under no circumstances, to Sean Ryder get on the stage.
Hmm, yeah. No, that is fantastic. It's great. I mean, we've sort of jumped in, but I mean, let's take it back a little bit. So in, what was it like, I say, growing up? I mean, you've mentioned in the book, it was really what, the Stones and Led Zepp and T-Rex, that kind of era, really. Was that, that was for you what music was all about, what really turned you onto it?
It was glam, actually. I mean, the first poster I ever put on my wall was T-Rex. I know that the first record I ever bought with my own money was Solid Gold Easy Action. One of the first albums that I ever kind of, that really started making me think there's magic here, was Electric Warrior. And then the whole Roxy Music, Mott the Hoople, you know, all of those bands. And somebody introduced me to the Stones at the point at which they were in between Goat's Head Soup and It's Only Rock and Roll.
Okay.
So the first album I bought by the Stones was It's Only Rock and Roll, bought the day it came out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they have subsequently been, I think, and probably are my favourite band, if for no other reason than between 1969 and the Mick Taylor years, effectively.
Yeah.
I genuinely don't believe anybody has ever executed what it is to be a rock and roll band more irreverently, more dangerously. You know, people were dying in their company. They were trying to kill themselves. you know, and of course you have Altamont, which for me is the point where everything changes.
Yeah.
And Gimme Shelter, just godlike.
Yeah.
And irregardless of what's happened to them subsequently, and I think they're still a great rock and roll band. I've seen them many, many times. For me, in that period, they were untouchable. And I've seen nothing that's come subsequently to change my mind about that.
Yeah.
I work with Public Enemy. You talk about danger, and you talk about the ability for a band to shock. You know, I think that you know, Elvis in 54 was more shocking than Public Enemy were singing about killing cops in you know, in 91 or whenever it was that they were. I guess it would have been 80 something. Whenever it was when they were doing that. There's the ability of an audience to be shocked versus the ability of a band to shock.
Yeah.
And audiences get less and less, you know, able to be really kind of discombobulated by what this or that rock star's doing.
Mm.
But there was that point, that moment where every, you know, all bets were off, I think.
Mm. Well, it's also, you can tell when it's artifice and you can tell when it's real, can't you, I think?
Yeah, absolutely.
And something like, you know, Keith Richards is not artifice, you know, and same as Liam, like, you know, and I think that was one of the things that why, you know, what meant a lot to us getting into Oasis as teenagers was, here's a band, they're not art school boys, these are working class geezers. You felt that gang mentality. You felt this is a gang, this is a group of lads, you know, and no different to us.
They absolutely were with shared experiences and you know, all coming from the same side of the tracks. That was a very real thing. And you know, the incredible thing about Liam, regardless of where our relationship went, I have nothing but admiration for anybody who has the courage to go into the world and not filter anything.
Yeah.
Now, it would be a really messy place if we all did that. You know, you know what I mean? At some point, you kind of have to say, no, your bum doesn't look big.
Yeah.
Liam's never going to do that. I don't think that's changed. Liam is going to tell you exactly what he thinks, or sometimes what he doesn't think. You know, sometimes the brain doesn't get involved in the process, but you're going to get a completely emotional and honest response to whatever the hell it was that you asked, or whatever the hell it was is happening around him.
Mm.
And that's a really admirable thing, I think, for a rock and roll star.
Yeah. And when you look at it now, and I mean, he seems to, I don't know if you followed his sort of recent like interviews and how things have been going on this As You Were tour, but he seems like an absolute pussycat now. Do you sit there and go, bloody hell, he must be a piece of cake to look after now. Well, think about what I went through in 94, 95.
Well, you know, he was never that difficult or challenging, apart from, a number of occasions, most of which are fairly well documented.
Yeah.
But the real drama, actually, and sort of the greatest... the greatest difficulty on the road was the sibling thing, was the Liam Noel thing. You know, that was genuinely damaging to be around for anybody who was very, very close to it, and notably for other members of the band, because it was real. That again, you know, there was no pretend about it. They didn't wait for the cameras to fall out. They fell out whenever the hell they fell out. You know, and sometimes it was genuinely. A violent thing to be around. You know, but there were occasions where, you know, my role was to protect one or other from one or other.
Yeah, yeah. But then it's hard,
not,
I suppose.
And not the great public, or the great British Unwashed.
Yeah, but I suppose it's difficult because you're also looking at it like, well, these are my employers, and if this tour ends because someone's been lamped and it is disappearing off, then that's the end of the gig, you know, and that's the end of the band. We've just got to keep them together at least.
That is actually the hardest part of the job. It's the most important part of the job. You know, any tour, no matter how small or how big, your role as one of Rock's worker bees is to make sure that at whatever time the show is scheduled, it happens, and the band are ready to do what they're supposed to do. You know, and looking forward to it. And the other thing that I don't think people realise is how incredibly hard they work when they are hot.
Right.
Because everybody wants a piece of them.
Yeah.
And at that point in the early stages, you need the NME as existed then. You know, you need whatever press is out there. You can't be cavalier with them in a way that you can be once you sold 100 million records. When you sold 100 million records, you can tell the press, we'll see you at this time in this place for this amount of time, and here's 15 things you can't talk about. But in those early days, when anybody comes knocking, this radio station, no matter how small in France, we're going to do it.
Yeah,
you know, and we need to turn up on time, and those things are challenging because that's a work ethic that, with the best will in the world, that group of people didn't have.
But I mean, going back to like the question, it was quite a facetious question, but you know, you're dealing with pretty, you know. It's like children getting. I remember talking to. I interviewed Anjali Dutt, who was one of the people that engineered Definitely Maybe, and you know, yeah. For her it was like just like dealing with a bunch of kids. You know, just sort of just trying to get them into the room at the same time. And you know, I've got three kids, and you're like, you know, you'll have one of them with their shoes on, and you say, okay, great, you've got your shoes on, you sit there. And you run off to sort the other one out, and then that one's taking their shoes off again. You go, what are you doing? Get back. You know.
That is a perfect analogy. It was very, very much like that. I mean, having said that, but they weren't all like that. I mean, Bonehead, Gwigsy, you know, they were where they needed to be. To be fair, Tony as well, in those very early days, Tony, Bonehead, Gwigsy would be where they were supposed to be, eyes rolling at why Liam wasn't,
yeah.
You know, but they would be where they were. It was really just about making sure that Liam was where he needed to be, pretty much from a logistic point of view,
okay.
Which wasn't without challenge. But I'm not going to pretend that it was a quest for world peace or anything, you know.
But did not just do your head in, like, I mean, what? Come on, Liam, you've just got one thing to do, please.
I think if you're going to work that closely with a band, then it becomes critical that you are in some way or another emotionally connected with what it is you're doing that day, and you have an admiration for them as artists. That makes it that much more easy. I could forgive Liam anything when I saw him do what he was there to do, at 8:30, 9:30, whatever time the show was. When Liam got up on stage and was Liam, whatever we'd been through the course of the day, you forgive instantly. And I've been lucky. I come at this from the point of view of being a fan. You know, I'm somebody who put posters on the wall. I'm somebody who bought records the day they came out. I'm somebody who got excited about these things and took umbrage when this or that reviewer didn't see the magic in a record that I saw the magic in. You know, so to be a fan and then to have the chance to work with these incredible people was in itself an amazing thing and reward in itself. But you're right. Look, if you didn't have any kind of emotional connection with what they were doing, then you might see it in a very kind of black and white, look, this is really simple, you're supposed to be here. It just isn't like that. And at the end of the day, I think our rock and roll stars should be a little bit disorganized. I think they should be extraordinarily dangerous, and I think they should be real. And they were all of those things.
The thing about getting thrown off ferries, blah, 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 getting deported, is something that I'm not proud about. If you're proud about getting thrown off ferries, then why don't you go and support West Ham? Get the fuck out of my band and go be a football hooligan, right? Because we're musicians, right? We're
football
hooligans.
You're only gutsy because you was in bed fucking...
No, I'm not at all. Listen.
Bullshit.
He says, right, here's a quote for you from my manager, Marcus Russell, right?
He's a fucking other fucking...
Shut up, you dick, right? He gets off the ferry after getting fucking deported. I'm left in Amsterdam with my dick out like a fucking spare prick at a fucking wedding. Shut up, right? He gets off the ferry. Marcus says, what are you fucking doing? You know, what the fuck's got...
Wonderful, magical, wonderful.
What are you doing all that? He says, right?
Yeah.
These lot think it's rock and roll to get thrown off a ferry.
No, don't.
To get... Shut up. These lot think it's rock and roll to get thrown... Shut the fuck up, man. These lot think... Am I going to have to say this, fat? Are you going to shut up? These lot think it's rock and roll to get thrown off a ferry, right, to come into hotel fires, to get everybody at it,
and they go,
shut up. They start thinking, hey, it's rock and roll.
Do
you know what my manager said to him? He said, nah, rock and roll is going to Amsterdam, doing your gig, playing your music. That's rock and roll,
right?
And coming back and saying, we blew him away. Not getting thrown off the ferry like some fucking scout schlepper with your fucking with being handcuffed. That's football hooliganism.
No, it isn't.
And I won't stand for
it. No, it isn't. They sit
and they all got. And listen, they all got fined £1,000 each.
Didn't at all.
Yes, they fucking did.
Yes, you stick your £1,000 right up your fucking ass until it comes out of your fucking fingers.
I will do that.
Let's have another couple of questions from the guys. Ronnie Ubi, who is at Rubber Revolver, asks, ask him what a tour manager is. I mean, what are the duties of a tour manager?
It depends on the tour, actually. You know, if you're tour managing a band that has success, then you are a logistician and administrator, largely, because you will have production assistants and you will have producers and you'll have this incredibly extended crew, all of whom you can delegate much of the responsibility to, and then it becomes your role just to make sure that the things that are supposed to be happening happen, but actually somebody else is making them happen.
Okay.
And actually you have less to do with the band as well. The artist will probably have some kind of personal assistant or retinue or what have you. Whoever's touring the Rolling Stones, for example, at the moment, their tour manager is their chief executive officer. It gets interesting when you're touring with a band like Oasis at that time in their career. We did not have a production manager. We didn't have most of the crew that in a perfect world we would have had. We didn't have a monitor engineer. You know, we had a front of house engineer, so there's that animal creating the noise for the audience, but we didn't have a monitor engineer. We would pick up a monitor engineer at each gig that we went to, some of whom were better than others, some of whom had no idea what Oasis was supposed to sound like, some of whom couldn't stand Oasis, and yet they were responsible for the sound that the band picked up on stage. And you know, when you don't have huge amounts of money to throw at problems to fix them, then you kind of need to be able to turn your hand to anything.
Sure.
And that's fun. That is the most fun you're ever going to have on the road, without a shadow of a doubt. Massively challenging, but it is fun. Mm. So in those days, in those early days, I liaised with the record company, liaised with press, liaised with the television companies, liaised with the venue security, do personal security, check them into the hotels, make sure their luggage went to their... I mean, it's just... Everything, because the money isn't there to employ somebody else to do it.
Sure.
And also in those days, the bespoke software didn't exist. It exists now. Computers were were not quite as agile as they are these days. So a lot of stuff happened on the fly. I look back at my old tour itineraries, and there's a huge amount of handwritten stuff in there that probably doesn't exist at all anymore.
No, you'd imagine it's all, everyone's got reminders on their iPhone, pinging them
exactly
and things like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I love the, one of my favourite films is Spinal Tap. And just reading that, I can't help but imagine, you know, their manager with the cricket bat running around and it was Ian St. Hogg.
Yeah,
I love that.
Yeah. Genius movie.
Yeah, and when he says, So, you're playing these smaller and smaller venues now. Are they becoming less popular? No. Our appeal is becoming more selective. Spot on. But I love it. And that's, yeah, I just love that he's wandering around with a cricket bat. And they said, when they were, I've heard Christopher Guest interviewed, and they sort of said, well, what was the inspiration for it? And they said that there was some English band in a hotel, and the bass player's there is just like, I lost my bass.
People during Spinal Tap would come up after the movie, and many bands would come up to us and say, oh, I know that's, yeah. I know who that is. Oh, yeah. That's BAFTA. I said, what? That's BAFTA. Yeah, the guy in that band in, no, it's not BAFTA. I don't even know who that was. BAFTA. The guy, you know, in that group. I don't know who BAFTA is. There's no BAFTA. People believe what they want to see in certain things, and there's nothing autobiographical, they're just things. Well, Spinal Tap, the example is that I was in a hotel in Los Angeles waiting for a friend in the lobby, and an English band was checking in. This was 1974. The manager and I think there were four of them, they went up to the desk and he started doing the thing, and I was just waiting for my friend, and the manager says to one of them, where's your bass? What? Where's your bass? I don't know, I think I left it at the airport. You what? I don't know. You left your bass at the airport. I don't know, where is it? Well, I don't know, I'm asking you. Well, it went on for 15 minutes. I don't think I've ever been happier.
You know, and you've got these, tour manager going, well, where did you leave it? I don't know. You know, and something like that. And you think, I mean, it was one of those where you just sort of thought, what have you done? And you've had a last minute trying to find something.
I remember at one point, I remember where we were. We actually stopped an aircraft from taking off because somebody was convinced that our flight case was still on the runway.
Oh, my goodness.
It was a relatively small aircraft making a small flight, short journey. It wasn't sort of great big... industrial carrier. There were probably no more than sort of 50 people on the flight, but we stopped the aircraft. We stopped it from taking off by standing in the doorway, insisting that we were going to get this flight case opened up and prove that it was ours. And of course, it wasn't. So now we're on the runway opening somebody else's flight case to find out that it's got nothing to do with us. And then it's a very sheepish, really sorry, you can go now.
That is fantastic. Oh god. Okay, let's have a look at what else have we got here, because I always often get questions from people and I just end up getting into the chat and then completely forgetting about them. Irene Supersonic, who is brilliant on Twitter, says, what do you think about the directions the band members have chosen these days? Do you approve of them? How did you imagine the future of Oasis back when you were the tour manager? And she also just says, please tell him his book is amazing because it's nothing but the truth.
Wow. Well, that's a really lovely thing to hear. Firstly, one of the interesting ways that she's phrased that is, do I approve? Who cares if I approve? I'm fairly confident that none of the band care whether I approve or not. I'm not sure I ever sort of sat down and made any predictions, really. The bust up and where they are, there is and always has been, I think, a degree of inevitability to that. So that never came as a surprise. That Noel would then go on and do his own thing again, there's no surprise there. That it took Liam a while to do his own thing, there's no surprise there either.
Mm.
But that he's found his feet with it, that's terrific.
Mm.
I think that's absolutely fantastic. because he's such a genuine person. And again, irregardless of where our relationship ended up, I've got nothing but admiration for him as a rock and roll star, and I kind of like rock and roll stars. he's unchanging. I'm sure he's changed a huge amount, but in terms of that irreverence, in terms of that swagger, that has never left him. You know, in much the same way that Rotten manages to carry these things off. You know, Liam's in danger of becoming a national treasure. That's the problem, isn't it?
I know. Well, that's the thing. When you get to that point, and it's like, oh, you know, it's you can't be. You know, when the punks are then the establishment, it's like, well, hold on a minute. You know what? It is funny. What have we got? Supernova Dragon on Twitter says, what does he think should have happened after Bonehead and Gwigs left the band? Do you think they should have split or taken a longer break?
Interesting. For me, the iteration of the band that makes the most sense and has the most value is the Alan White, Bonehead, Gwigsy, Liam and Noel iteration. I absolutely get why Noel let Tony go. At the point at which you lose people like Bonehead and Gwigsy, you've lost something intrinsic, and really important. And for me, again, incredibly subjective thing, that was kind of an end to it, really.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Stones when Mick Taylor left. Ronnie Wood, great, brilliant fit, I know, amazing player, but post Mick Taylor, not really ever as damaging, as interesting, as dangerous, as as powerful as previously. And I kind of felt that there's an integrity that you lose, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't around when those things happened, so I'm not quite sure how they happened. And I suspect that knowing Bonehead and Gwigsy, I've seen Bonehead a few times subsequently, I suspect it was as much as anything, this isn't fun anymore.
And as well,
but
I suppose
still a machine to feed, you know?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, it's quite funny that, you know, it's almost, we've joked on here before that it's like being an Oasis. It's often like a Bermuda Triangle, because some people that were involved in it just literally disappear off the face of the earth and do no press ever. Like Gwigs and Alan White have just done nothing. They just disappear. And, but then if you think about it, it's like, well, Gwigs wasn't from the Brit school, you know. Gwigs wasn't at the, you know, that Sylvia whatever academy, you know. He was just a geezer that his mate got him to play the bass in a band, in a little local pub band, and they just happened to have become the best band in the country. And so,
absolutely.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. And Gwigs and Bonehead were remarkably ordinary human beings.
Yeah.
Grounded, always grounded, even with all the sort of chaos around them, you know, that they were two very, very grounded individuals.
Yeah.
Gwigs particularly, and Gwigs settled into a sort of happy domesticity pretty early on, actually. And I think, to the best of my knowledge, he's with the same girl that he was, you know, back then.
Yeah.
And but I remember Gwigsy boasting to me, he'd just taken on an apartment off the Finchley Road, and he had two washing machines, which was a big deal to him, you know. I've got two washing machines, Robert. You know? I've made it, you know.
What
does any man need? Two washing machines.
We are confident about it. We have been since the day we joined the band. And the day we heard no.
Okay, but it changed. I mean, first time I read a story with you was when you played in New York. You said, like, you covered, like, I'm the Walrus, and you said, like, okay, this is a song of the best band ever. And next time I heard you on the radio, and I read a couple of new stories in Holland here, in papers, it was like, the Beatles? Like, no, we're better. You can't possibly.
Why not?
You're laughing, so you know.
I don't know. We might not be yet, but our debut album's better than their debut album.
Why? Because there's no covers on it?
No, I think when I listen to our debut album, I think it's mega. I think it's brilliant. You know what I mean? I love the Beatles. I love every song they ever recorded. I love it. And even the ones that, you know, even the ones that aren't quite up to it are still brilliant. You know what I mean? But if you listen, I think if you listen to our debut album and you listen to their album, their debut album sounds like it was the debut album of the band of the 60s. You know what I mean? And our debut album sounds like a debut album of a band of the 90s. And I think it's better.
So will your next record be like totally different? Because the Beatles like made every record special.
Oh, we would never release anything if it wasn't special to us. And that's all you can go off, really, you know what I mean? And you can obviously, you can try songs out at gigs and see what the reaction is, but at the end of the day, if you don't stay special to yourself, then you can't be special to anyone else.
But that's the thing, I suppose, if you've made a bit of money, and my understanding is Alan White has then, you know, sensibly put his money into property, you know, and then has done very well out of it. And therefore, if they made sufficient money being on those records that, you know, yeah, you're not getting Noel Gallagher money, but because you didn't write the songs, but you're getting sufficient money through all the other elements to it that, yeah, if you invest it properly, then you're okay. You know, you don't need to go out and start another band or do something else or get a day job because you've invested your money and you can live off it. And I think that, and if you don't want to, someone like Griggs or Alan White that just were never interested really in the spotlight, then fine, just you can just disappear and go off and do your thing. And I think it is quite refreshing, actually. I interviewed Steve White, Alan's brother.
Yeah.
And he just said, look, you don't have to. If you don't want to be on Facebook and Twitter and whatever else, you don't need to. Just go and live your life, you know. And it's almost like we're sort of going, but we want to. You know, I want to. It's not fair.
We want to know.
Yeah, it's not fair. Absolutely. I know.
And actually, you know, you're right. Griggsy and Alan have disappeared without trace. Neither of whom will be unhappy about that, I'm sure. Both of whom, I'm sure, as you say, have been very sensible with the money that they did make. Bonehead, I know, still makes music. He was writing with a friend of mine, a guy called Alex Lipinski, who, by the way, if you're an Oasis fan, I would definitely check out. You can hear something of the band in there, and his vocals are outstanding. But it was through Alex that I bumped back into Bonehead again, and we were chatting about this and that. And, you know, Bonehead was like, because he did this thing with Vinnie Peculiar, and he's always out there doing stuff, and he's now doing it because of why he always did it. You know, Bonehead has got the most eclectic record collection of anybody else in Oasis.
Yeah.
You know, Bonehead's the guy that has got records by The Cure. He's got goth, he's got rockabilly. He really has got this incredibly broad spectrum of taste. And so it doesn't surprise me that he turns up with Vinnie Peculiar. Doesn't surprise me that he still wants to make music, because Bonehead is still a musician.
Yeah,
I'm not saying that Griggsy wasn't, but he certainly wasn't first and foremost.
Yeah. Yeah, and I love the bit in your book where they're going around ordering drinks and it's like, oh, JD and Coke, JD and Coke, JD goes to Bonehead, bottle of red wine.
Yeah.
Red wine, not a glass. Bottle. That's the standard. I love it.
That was his blunt instrument of choice. Just red wine, you know.
Yeah.
Lots of it, mine, but red wine.
Yeah, no, I love it. Okay, here's a silly one. Alan Davidson at 123 Ali D. If all past members of Oasis were put in a room in a fight to the death, who'd be the last man standing?
Wow. I'm going to say Griggsy.
Griggs?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to say Griggsy. Griggsy was something of an athlete, and actually, well, I suppose it depends on at what point you stick them all in a room.
Yeah.
Do you put them in there tomorrow, or do you put them in at the height of their, you know, at the point of, seeing as this is completely hypothetical, let's put them in a room at the point at which they were at their height of their powers.
Their physical peak,
right?
Okay.
Exactly. So we get Griggsy in 94. Blah blah blah, and on that basis, because Griggsy boxed a bit and played a bit of football and was a very very good cricketer, I would say probably Griggsy.
Ah, well, Tony McCarroll. Someone asked the same question to him when I spoke to Tony, and he said definitely him because he had that drummer strength.
He does. That's very true. Yeah, that is very true. I guess we'll never know.
Yeah. Well, yes.
I guess we'll never know. Let's hope we never have to find out.
Yeah.
Let's hope nobody ever actually does that, you know.
Yeah. That would be good, though. That would be entertaining. I was going to say, so, I mean, what I really love as well, and one of the things that you do in the book is that you don't bury the lead. You start off at the end, which is a really good way to start it. And I just really wanted to dig into that because it's one of those things that often people that have dealt with Oasis, there does tend to be quite a you know, an unpleasant end. And then that's kind of it. You know, it doesn't tend, you know, and so you obviously had this situation in Paris and so, you know, that's just to fill in. So they're doing this radio interview and Liam being the cock of the north and being the top man is suddenly put out by the fact that Eddie Izzard's there in PVC and red lipstick and speaking in French. And I can just imagine seeing Liam go, hold on a minute, I'm being shown up by like the clever kid in the class. You know, I'm not having it. And then so therefore it all kind of goes a bit wrong from there.
Yeah, so... So I'm into this. I'm into this idea. This idea, it's a positive thing, man. And I took my last show, Glorious, I took to Paris and I did it in French. The French people came and they stared at me with that look on their eyes of, quoi? Because, you know, there's no stand-up in France and they're not used to English people speaking French. But I was doing it, you know, because I thought it would be a positive... Because we could be the biggest melting pot in the world. Biggest melting pot in the world. 500 million people. All we got to do is melt a bit. Just move it around. Fucking move it around. And it was partly that and partly just to go, yeah.
That's pretty much it, actually. You know, it was everybody had an awful lot to drink throughout the course of the day, which never helps. We were being interviewed for a little radio station in Paris with Eddie Izzard. He was also being interviewed because he was coming to Paris later to do a show. And it was fine until, as you say, Eddie started answering questions in fluent French, which completely charmed the radio host, and suddenly the conversation became much more about Eddie and much less about Liam and Oasis. And to be fair, in the band was Liam and Gwigsy and Bonehead. Alan and myself. But Liam was the only one that was doing the interview. He was the only one that was having this conversation. The rest of the band were hanging out, having a drink, and chatting to some French birds, you know. And you could see the situation, you know, going south. And in the end, Liam literally stood up, threw his chair across the room, and kicked off severely. Live on French radio.
I would love to get that bit of audio. It's one of those things I've searched for occasionally on YouTube, but I don't think it will surface. Oh goodness! And then where it goes from there later on, he's simmering all day, and then.
Well, after that had happened, I thought, well, let's get out of here. This doesn't end well. Liam wanted to leave. I said, look, I'll come with you. He and I, we had a couple of cars that were ferrying us around the town. He and I took one. We went to a bar that we as a band used to like. And he and I sat there and he calmed down, cooled down, and we were getting to a place where I thought, okay, this will end as well as this could ever end, you know.
Mm.
And then unfortunately, the record company representative turned up. And he started. Liam and she ended up in an incredible row in the back of the car. And Liam, in fairness, was pretty much out of order. And I was trying to reconcile the pair of them. And Liam took that as a personal slight. That was like, well, you're on her side, you know. And literally threw himself out of the car. Literally threw himself out of the car. While we were doing, I don't know how fast we were going, but we weren't going as fast as I thought we were because it's central Paris and you can't drive that quickly, but we were doing 20 miles an hour all day long.
Jeez.
And Liam just opened the door and went, and then I followed him.
But what's your first, so you just say that and I followed him, but I wouldn't follow him. I'd go, oh, you, but you just...
Yeah, but I used to jump out of aeroplanes for a living. So
oh, fair play, I suppose.
So didn't seem quite so unusual. And my job is to look after him.
Yeah.
You know, it probably was a fairly irrational decision, but I followed him nonetheless. So now we're both rolling down the street, and then as described in the book, from nowhere, and I didn't see this coming at all. He just punched me.
Yeah.
And then punched me again. And then I lifted him up and carried him across the road and bounced him off a bus stop. We stood, looked at each other. And that was pretty much it. I knew that was it.
You knew?
Yeah, I knew that was it.
Okay.
Unfortunately, those kind of run-ins between he and I were happening with greater frequency, and that was in part my fault, and without creating any excuses, I believe that my job was not to just nod and say yes, how high.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I believe that my job was to get stuff done, and that the things that we were trying to do were important, and that we couldn't just sack them off if we didn't feel well or if we had a hangover or blah blah blah, and most of the time, not all of the time, the reason that we were late for something or the reason that something may or may not happen was because of something that Liam had done. Why not? He's a rock star. He's I think 22 years old at the time. Why not? That's his job. That's what he's supposed to do. But my job is to get us to here or to there. And so increasingly he and I were having run-ins with each other, and I wasn't as diplomatic as I could and should have been.
Okay.
And that's because I'd come straight out of the back of working with Jack Bruce, Ginger Baker, and Gary Moore. Now, I'm a huge fan of Cream, and when I went into that gig, that tour, I treated Jack and Ginger with way too much respect.
Right.
Almost fan-like awe. And they ran circles around me, and it was the most unpleasant tour I've ever been a part of. To work with musicians of that caliber who were making incredible music again. Anyone in doubt? I don't want to go until I found it all out.
And then, so I mean, in terms of the practicality, so you're physically there in Paris, you think, uh-oh, it's over. So is it Marcus Russell, or who do you then speak to and say?
I called Marcus, and I called Noel, and I got a voicemail from Marcus, and I was able to speak to Noel, and at this point, none of it had really. This was immediately after the event. This was my getting back to the hotel, probably 45 minutes after what we just talked about had happened. So, you know, I actually wanted to be the first person to have the conversation. I wanted to jump before I was pushed.
Okay.
But there was never any doubt in my mind that the push would come. And in a conversation that Noel and I had subsequently, he was like, well, you know, we're blood. And because of where we are with the band, he and I are joined at the hip.
Yeah.
You know, there is only one way this can end. And Liam was pretty adamant that he didn't want to work with me anymore. And I get it. I have no issue or drama with that.
Sure.
I totally understand how we got to where we got to. With hindsight, I might have played it differently. When I look back at all of these things, you look back at any band that you work with and you think, did I add any value? I think the value I added with Oasis was that they never missed an interview, they never missed a TV, they never missed a gig, you know, at a point where actually they couldn't afford to.
Yeah.
You know, if tomorrow, if they still existed as a band, well, they could pull gigs left, right and centre, they could cancel interviews left, right and centre, and it would make absolutely no difference to anything.
Mm.
But then, it made a big difference if you didn't turn up at this radio station or you didn't turn up at this TV station.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you lost their support.
Absolutely.
And Creation were trying to build very successfully after.
Yeah. And we saw what happened. I mean, we saw what happened after with the fated, like, later American tours that just went horribly wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, is that a coincidence? Did they need an ex-SAS person to keep them in line? You know, and
you always need somebody. Somebody. Marcus was very good at this, but you need somebody who's going to tell you the truth, or at least try to. I'm not going to pretend for a second that I was always right, or that my version of events in any given set of circumstances is necessarily the truth. But just as Liam came at things from a point of integrity, so did I. You know, I would not. I remember saying to Liam in Tokyo when we had a really important set of press commitments to meet on the Wednesday morning, and Liam wanted to go berserk on the Tuesday night. And I remember saying, Liam, it's Tuesday. You know, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, it's Tuesday. You know, we are not, nothing good is going to happen. Nothing, we ain't missing anything by going to bed early. It had no effect whatsoever, and he stayed until stupid o'clock, and nothing happened, you know. It was just a procession of trawling from club to club, from empty club to empty club, and, you know.
Yeah, and so following that, I mean, how did it then come to the process of writing the book? I mean, did you have, like, legal concerns? Because I know that there's various people that could have written books that haven't. Was there any impediment to you doing that, or was that there was nothing to stop you?
The impediment was that they didn't want me to. And when I say they, I suspect what I mean by they is record companies and etc. And indeed sought to stop the publication of the book. But they ultimately they couldn't. And they couldn't because there's nothing remotely libelous in there. There's nothing untruthful in there. And actually, for me, the book did well. I mean, it sold well around the world. It got some really good reviews, far better than it deserves, I suspect. but be that as it may, it got them. But I was at the NME Awards probably 3 years later, and I bumped into Noel for the first time, and he and I had a beer and a chat, and he said to me, your book is the best account of my band that anybody's written, and it's the truth.
Fantastic.
That will do for me.
Well, that's better than a review in the Scotsman or whatever, isn't it? That's the one.
Absolutely.
Good. And have you seen? You saw Noel then. You mentioned you've seen Bonehead. Have you seen Noel or Liam in the following years?
No, I saw Noel again at another NME Awards. I've seen Bonehead really quite recently on a number of occasions because he was making music with a friend of mine, and that was really nice.
Here's a thought for every man who tries to understand what's in his head. What's in his head?
else. I've seen Mark Coyle. I've seen Owen Morris, Tim Abbott, obviously, Alan McGee. That's pretty much it, I guess. Robbie McGrath, but Robbie McGrath was more of a friend of mine than the band. Robbie McGrath was the front of house engineer that replaced Mark Coyle.
Oh, okay.
He came out to Japan with us when Mark sort of knocked it on the head. And Robbie was like, you know, his pedigree, he's front of house Rolling Stones, front of house AC/DC. You know, he's a first class sound engineer.
Mm.
But stepping into Mark Coyle's shoes was a, I think, difficult and unpleasant process for him, certainly.
Right. Well, he wasn't his mate from home, was he? So.
Yeah, no, absolutely right. And that's another interesting dynamic. A lot of people around the band were pals on wages, and that in itself is an interesting one. When a band begins to develop, begins to enjoy success, begins and the venues get bigger and the touring agenda gets tougher, you need people that know what they're doing.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Not pals on wages.
Yeah.
Keep the pals on wages if you must, but you then need an infrastructure that's going to make it work for you.
Sure.
Which, of course, is what Oasis have done subsequently. And, of course, what Noel does now, you know. Mm. People around here will be at the very highest caliber.
Yeah, no.
And expensive.
Yeah. Yes. No. Absolutely. It is. It's tough because you want to have the I, that, as we were saying, that's what we loved about them. It was the group, the gang mentality. But when you get to that level, you can't be that anymore. It has to be you have to build it out and have the professionals and have it to be a bit more pro. And it does. You have to do that, but it does lose some of the magic of it. So
it does. That I genuinely feel that to be with that band at that time, when the blue touch paper had just been lit, was a real privilege.
Yeah, sure.
And it's playing those small shows and watching the crowds grow and watching the swell.
Mm.
And actually riding that swell and the chaos of it. And the maelstrom and the not knowing and the, you know, it was impossible to plan things because things were moving so very, very quickly.
Mm.
If you have any empathy for the whole kind of dynamic of what it is to be in or around a rock and roll band, that has to be the best part of it.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, we'll kind of wrap it up. But one of the things I just wanted to say, is there any particularly a memory of, you know, I know we focused on a couple of like the very negatives, but is there any real abiding memory of like that just brings a smile to your face when you sit back and think, ah, oh, that was a great night, or that was a great sort of moment?
But they're very low key. They're not particularly, you know, resonant in rock zeitgeist. It would be stuff like conversations, a one-to-one conversation with Noel in a tour bus crossing America.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember one particularly when he and I were when the pressures of the success that they were having were beginning to bite, when touring, although still an adventure, was becoming a bit too much like work, and that was when Liam and Noel really started stepping into one another. And Noel and I having a conversation about that in a tour bus on the way to Los Angeles. And Liam had said to me, I just need Noel to say, what you do is amazing.
Hmm.
And I brokered that with Noel in the back of the bus, and Noel just said to me, and again without any, no irony, no, I mean, he's a very funny guy, smart guy, but this was deadpan. It was, well, he gets to sing my songs, what more does a little fucker want? and so my answer would be, there are many moments, but they are quiet moments, they're moments of intimacy, they're moments that the newspapers aren't terribly interested in, to be honest, but you just think, you're part of something and seeing something that other people, don't get to see. And in truth, I think that's why Tim and I are going to do what we're going to do, because what we're saying is, you know, there was always a door that we closed.
Yeah.
there was always a place that nobody else got to go apart from those seven or eight people. And what Tim and I are going to try and do in terms of firstly just sharing some stories, but also saying, ask us a question. You know, any question you ask, we'll answer truthfully, is to open that door and just show the, you know, the real fans something of what it was like to be there then.
Oh, absolutely. Well, that's brilliant. So let's just mention that again. So it is the 21st of July. It's in Weston-super-Mare, and I think it's at Reaper Events.
Reaper Events are putting it on. It's at the Winter Gardens. There's two very good cover bands, an Oasis and a Blur cover band. And Tim and I are going to probably do some more of this over the course of the next 12 months or so, but this is the one that we're... This is the first time we're going to, you know, we're going to trot it out. And if for no other reason than Tim has got some unbelievable footage.
Oh, so you're going to be playing it on the on like a big screen?
Absolutely.
Oh, wow.
When we reference X or Y, we will have some kind of video footage from that moment to sort of authenticate it. You know, stuff from dressing rooms and hotel rooms and tour buses and the stuff that, that frankly nobody's ever seen before.
Sold. Sold.
Come on down, Jake.
Well,
down.
I'm
on the list, mate.
Well, I should be there. I mean, I'm supposed to be at a local festival that weekend, which is my sort of local, you know, music festival. But there's no one really great. I think it's like the Cortinas are headlining. It's not a band I'm a particularly big fan of. Which gets me some grief on here because a lot of Oasis fans love them, but then I thought, oh, you know what? Forget that. I've got to come down and see you guys, and so I've been in touch with the guys at Reaper, but I mean, we'll have a, I've spoken to a few people about doing some sort of like live Oasis podcast kind of event as well, and it's tricky. I think you do have to have, you know, the tribute band playing or something, just to make it, because it's difficult to get people out of, you know, off their asses to go and just watch a couple of people chat. Yeah. I mean, maybe if we could get...
As entertaining as we undoubtedly are, Jamie, you're right, you're absolutely right.
It is tough, but I mean, because I've sort of, you know, as I'm in touch with Tony and I've been, you know, in touch with a couple of the others, and it's sort of, yeah, we could figure something out, we could do something, but I think it does need to tie in. But now, we'll stay in touch. But I think this will be a really nice sort of tester and see how it goes. So everyone, it's at Reaper Events, and contact them and get involved. Come on down and very exciting. Good. All right.
Cool.
Well, we'll leave it there. Ian, what we always tend to finish with, though, I'm going to drop you in it now because I didn't mention this to you, is we always tend to finish with the favourite Oasis song of the guest. So is there a particular Oasis song you would like us to play out with?
Columbia Live.
Any particular live version that we can find?
I'm sure you've got it. There's a sort of a CD that was released in very limited numbers in Chicago. And the CD itself has everything written backwards on it.
Okay, yeah.
And the version of Columbia on that is particularly good.
All right, and why?
That was kind of when I started. That was when I joined the band, pretty much, and that was immediately post the train wreck that was the Los Angeles gig, and Liam apologizes for it. At the beginning, I think, Columbia. So it's very resonant. You know, I can hear that and be there again.
This one's called Columbia. And if you're there and you missed some of the gigs that we had to play last week, sorry, but we were pretty ill.
But in addition to that, that was just always, for whatever reason, that was always my favourite tune live. There's just something completely, it just feels unstoppable, you know?
Yeah, it's hypnotic, isn't it?
It's exactly that. And it's just a great tune.
Wonderful. Ian, well, thank you so much. Well, we will play out with Columbia, and I will hopefully see you on the 21st of July, and everyone, you need to get down there and also get hold of Ian's book, which is called Oasis, What's the Story?
It is.
Yeah, and then what? And the subtitle is, what is it? How the fuck did I become an Oasis tour manager?
Yeah, right. my publisher said we need to be a little bit more dramatic, so I was Oasis's road manager. Fuck me, what a gig.
That was it. That's it. Good. All right, Ian, well, thank you so much for your time. Much appreciated.
You're welcome. Thanks, James.
So I hope you guys enjoyed that discussion with Ian. It was really good fun to speak to him. And as I say, make sure if you can get to Weston-super-Mare for the 21st of July, I think it's really going to be worth it. I mean, to hear both Ian and Tim speak is one thing, but then to also have those, as you heard me say in the interview, sold, to have the video bits and the photos that we've never ever seen before go up on the screen, oh, that's the one for me. So, and to be able to get hold of some of that stuff would be absolutely fantastic. Also, just to let you know, I've been in touch with Tim, and the hope is that we will also speak to Tim and get that out to you, and hopefully before the 21st of July as well, to give that event another little push. So yeah, very exciting. So that will do it for today. Thank you very much for listening to the Oasis podcast. Make sure you are subscribed and liked on wherever you get podcasts from, particularly iTunes. And if you would be so bold as to write us a review on iTunes and give us a 5-star rating, that would be muchly appreciated. Please make sure you're following me at Oasis Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And you can put your money where your mouth is and support the show from as little as $1 per month over at Patreon, which is patreon.com/OasisPod. And I do really appreciate everyone who throws us even like $1 a month. It really does make a difference. So until next time, or until I see you at Finsbury Park, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.
I'm Richard Buskin.
And I'm James Corcoran.
And this has been
the Oasis Podcast. Very good. Great. Good.
Do you want to just do the Oasis Podcast, see if we can do it in time?
Yeah, with a beat between. All right.
Right. So, 1, 2, 3. This is
the Oasis Podcast. Very good.